Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. There have been some rumblings in the past week about the possibility of economic downturn, but right now, the economy is humming along with record low unemployment. With full employment, there are employers who can't fill job openings. However, the statistics can be misleading. Some of the jobs that have been filled don't pay that much, and there are those who have a hard time affording to pay for the essentials, like housing and food, even if they are working. That's where our guest today comes in. Businesswoman Sharon Ryan has adopted a model for her own company, Dasher Services, to employ economically fragile people, and has written about the model in her book, The Talent Pool: How to Find and Keep Dedicated People While Making a Lasting Impact. Sharon Ryan, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott. It's great to be here.
Also joining us today is David Black, President and CEO of the Harrisburg Regional Chamber and Capital Regional Economic Development Corporation Critic. Dave Black, good to see you again.
Hi, Scott. Great to be here.
And on the phone with us is Pennsylvania Secretary of Human Services, Teresa Miller. Secretary Miller, always glad to talk with you.
Good to be here. Thanks, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can also leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, so Sharon Ryan should mention that you are the co-writer of the talent pool that we'll be talking about the book this morning. Describe the model that you write about in the talent pool.
Great. Yes, Cindy Tolsma is the co-author of the book, and Cindy and I wrote the book for businesses that are already motivated to succeed in business by caring for their workforce. And the book includes a lot of detail about a model that we call the Team Member Prosperity and Success Model that we've developed through trial and error over the past 10 years that immerses people in a supportive environment that allows them to go from being economically fragile to economically stable.
Maybe we should identify who economically fragile people are.
Right. That's usually a great place to start. Economically fragile people are, by definition, people who are uncertain about their ability to meet their basic needs or meet the needs of those for whom they're responsible. So that can be food insecurity, transportation insecurity, housing insecurity. But by and large, economically fragile people are really not interested in you knowing that they're economically fragile. So a lot of people wonder who they are. And so what we've done, again, through trial and error, is understand how to identify people who are economically fragile. One of the most important points to make here is that when you take a coin and you think one side is poverty, if you flip it over and you ask people what's on the other side, a lot of people would say wealth. But it's not wealth. If you flip the coin of poverty, the other side, it's dignity. And economically fragile people are justifiably proud of their efforts to carve out a life, and they want their dignity.
I see. When you said that most people who are economically fragile, that they don't want other people to know, that plays right into what you were talking about with looking for dignity.
Yes. Dignity is, if anyone thinks about it long enough, they realize, you know, being able to make your own choices and live a happy, healthy life, it's very important to us. And when you are economically fragile, that's taken from you. And there's a lot of concern that people have about other people who are economically fragile and that they believe that it somehow involves character defects or choices. And most of us, if we stop and think about it, we're one catastrophe away from being economically fragile. It's just that what we focus on with the low-wage economically fragile is that they have very few chances to recover from a calamity.
Mm-hmm. Calamity that most people will think of as a high medical bill, something that is unexpected going into the hospital for, even if you are insured sometimes, that that could really hurt a family that is economically fragile. Let me turn to Secretary Teresa Miller for just a moment. Secretary, just a few weeks ago, we had a conversation on our program with the United Way of Pennsylvania about some research they had done and found some pretty high percentages in the 40 percentile range of people who are living in poverty, but also people who were just above that, who, as, and I guess as Sharon Ryan defines them, as economically fragile, that people who here in Pennsylvania were having a hard time making ends meet when it comes to the essentials, like housing, like food, transportation, all those things. In this day and age, when the economy is so good, why are there so many Pennsylvanians who are struggling to pay for the essentials?
I think that's a great question. And, you know, one of the groups that we've been really focused on recently are childcare workers, because I think they're a perfect example of a group where these are professionals. These are individuals who have full-time jobs. And half of them, we estimate, are relying on public assistance to meet their basic needs. So to your point, it's not even that they can't get a job. These are professionals. These are individuals who are raising our children. They're raising my child. And half of them need our services just to meet their basic needs because they're not making enough to be able to put food on their tables and to be able to pay their rent. And so they are, you know, as Sharon and you are pointing out, they're one car accident away or one unforeseen circumstance away from being in a really, really bad spot. But even with a full-time job, they're still struggling to make ends meet. Our wages have not kept up with the cost of living, and that's a huge problem for a lot of workers in Pennsylvania.
Before we get back to the book, Dave Black, something I hear often, and I know in your position that you probably hear it much more than me, but employers who are having trouble finding employees with the skills they need. Now, I would imagine, and tell me, Sharon, if this is true, that a lot of people who can be defined as part of that group of economically fragile people don't have the skills because they haven't gotten the training or the education to fill these kind of skilled positions. So are we talking about two different things here, Dave? I mean, skilled workers, we have a lack of skilled workers in this state and really across the country, but the people that we're talking about would seem to be ripe for potential workforce, but just don't have the skills.
Well, that's the interesting thing that Sharon and Dasher have done. I mean, they've created this ecosystem that brings economically fragile people into the workforce, helps them get their arms around their life to begin with, and then that allows them to build their skill sets while they're working at Dasher. This isn't just filling a minimum wage job, for lack of a better term. This is creating a positive culture to help people who are entering with perhaps fewer skill sets than what they need, but not only do they learn life skills, they also learn work skills, and so they can grow and become more valuable employees to Dasher, and quite frankly, if they leave Dasher, to other companies. So it's what I'm really excited about with what Sharon and Cindy have created out of Dasher is this culture within the business to bring people in. Who a lot of other companies probably wouldn't look at, build their self-confidence, build their knowledge about just work and life and how to balance things and then try to get them to a better place in the workplace.
Mm-hmm. So, Sharon, I'm sure our audience is waiting. Ask the question, Scotty. Ask the question. How does this work? How does this model work?
Well, you know, I think when you want to go from being economically fragile to economically stable, that requires people to change. And as employers, we can't require or make people change, but we can create a work environment, which I refer to as culture, that facilitates the change. And even when people are making changes in their lives, even for the better, there are consequences associated with making those changes. And as employers, we can mitigate or ameliorate many of those choices. And so it's just common sense to us that people who are worried about who are coming to work hungry, for example, which is something Secretary Miller has made a really excellent point about in the past, coming to work wondering about the safety of their children, and then expecting them to learn or provide excellent customer service. It's not It doesn't make sense. It's not common sense. And so what our model does is we expect people to have problems, and we engage them every day. I mean, we're a very high-touch environment, and we really want to understand what's going on outside their workplace. And so we have a variety of programs that support them, and when they're in crisis and when they're not in crisis and they just need further assistance. A classic example, really give you a sense of the team member prosperity and success model, is that when there are some employers that if you miss a work shift, you get a demerit, and if you get 3 demerits, you get fired. And say you have a flat tire, and it's your 3rd shift that you're going to miss, you're going to get fired. Well, at Dasher, if you miss a shift, we'll know why you did, and if you say I had a flat tire, we'll fix your tire. We'd rather do that than recruit another person who we have to start over with. And the costs of recruitment and retention are enormously expensive for businesses. And that's the business case for doing what we're doing. I think that just by keeping those workers on board, and we have a lot of data in the book about the cost of retention and or recruitment, but Dasher's retention rate is over 90%. So our turnover is in a single digit right now, and our goal is 0. Mm-hmm.
So just so everyone knows, they may not be familiar with Dasher. Dasher systems, what do you do?
Dasher, we communicate complex information to diverse populations. So we specialize, we have a special knowledge of the healthcare field, but we also communicate about auto emissions. We communicate about data incident response, complicated topics like professional licensure. So when we bring people in who we expect to have experience gaps, who we expect to have problems outside the workplace, what we really need them to do is align with our corporate culture and values, and we'll fix the rest. And we have many, many success stories of people who are now communicating complex information on the phone or in correspondence or in the field.
Earlier you said that many people who are economically fragile don't want other people to know. It's not like something they go around talking to other people about. Why would they open up to an employer? Why would they tell an employer that, we're having trouble putting food on the table this month?
It's really an interesting question, because a lot of the employers that I talk to about what we're doing, they assume that economically fragile people will just drain them dry. Like if they make money available to them, that they'll just all take it. And I always say that's a good problem to have, because the major problem you're going to have is people opening up to you. And so what it really requires is a culture of safety and a culture of trust and predictability. So as Dave mentioned, before, culture is important. And you can have core values, but what you really need to understand is, do people feel safe? And it takes a while to get that to the point where people feel safe enough to ask for help.
Mm. And again, I'm trying to picture some specific cases. When you say that people will take the money, so is there a pool for people who have emergencies, whether it be food, whether it be paying the rent, or just how does that work?
Well, we have 2 programs in that regard. Dasher itself as a company has a donor-directed fund. And so our employees can apply for a grant in the event that they have some calamity. For example, we had an employee who had a plumbing issue. We had another employee who had a fire above her in her apartment and was evicted immediately. So these are things where we can help them, grant them money, and we pay the service provider directly for those services. We pay for auto repairs and that sort of thing. But we also pay for high drug expenses that people incur. But we also have a program where we will start a starter emergency fund. We do a lot of financial education at Dasher. And so we'll have a starter emergency fund where we'll start a bank account with our employee participating. And over a period of a year, by saving about $12 a week, they have $600 in an account, and we put $400 in. So at the end of a year, they can have a $1,000 starter emergency fund, and that covers that makes a world of difference.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. And let me tell you about some of the programs that we have coming up here in the near future on Smart Talk. Some of the programs we're working on: invasive species in Pennsylvania waterways, advanced directives near end of life, and finding your family's military roots. We invite you to share your questions in advance by sending us a voice memo or leaving voicemail. See what's coming up at WITF.org/smarttalk. Today we're talking about a book. Actually, we're talking about a culture. A work culture. And our guest today, Sharon Ryan, who is CEO at Dasher Service Incorporated and author of The Talent Pool, How to Find and Keep Dedicated People While Making a Lasting Impact. David Black, President and CEO of the Harrisburg Regional Chamber and Critic, and Pennsylvania Secretary of Human Services, Teresa Miller. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Sharon, just have a few other questions about the model, if you will, and what you describe in the book, The Talent Pool. As I'm sitting here thinking about this, I'm thinking, well, there probably are people who are saying or asking, why not just pay higher wages? And wouldn't that help the people that you're trying to help who are employees?
To a certain extent, that's part of the problem. I mean, when I started out at this, I thought that if I paid people well and gave them good benefits, that would be what they needed. But it didn't have any impact on my turnover. And I noticed the quality of life. It didn't influence the quality of life for people, because as you think about economically fragile, it's a journey of the mind. It's how you feel and what you understand about money. And so there's a lot that goes into this besides paying higher wages. But the other thing is that when you think about people, there are a lot of people who make tons of money who are economically fragile, and it's a spending issue for them. I mean, they have the revenue. But when you look at low-wage economically fragile people, it's not necessarily a spending issue, but it could be. So you pay them more. There's like 20 people right behind them trying to get that money from them. And so they have to be disciplined financially to benefit from those higher wages.
Mm-hmm. Secretary Miller, Governor Wolf has proposed an increase in the minimum wage to $12 an hour. Eventually getting up to $15 an hour. I'm sure that you support that as part of the administration. But what Sharon just described there, just increasing the minimum wage, for example, doesn't seem to be like that's the answer to solving this problem.
I think she's right. I think one of the things we need to do a better job of, and you know, I was on your program not too long ago talking about our Keys program, which is our partnership with community colleges. I think wages are certainly one of the issues, but I think we also need to do a better job, and this is what I love about Sharon's model. We need to do a better job of investing in people. And at the end of the day, that's who's doing the work and making businesses successful. And we need to acknowledge that through more than just wages. And so, for example, for our department, when I think about what we've done historically to try to help people get to self-sufficiency and get to a place where they can support themselves and their families, I don't think we've done the best job we can do in really investing in people by giving them, for example, opportunities to get more education or training that would allow them really to get onto a career path that eventually would allow them to be off of public assistance long term. You know, I think I've said this on your show before, but I have yet to meet anyone, and they may exist, but I just haven't met anyone yet who wants to be on public assistance. Everybody I talk to talks about how they want a better life for themselves and their families, but they just don't have the opportunity to get that better life. So, you know, we're redesigning our existing employment and training programs, and we got money in the budget for our Parent Pathways model. And all of the things we're doing now are trying to do a better job of allowing people to have opportunities to get more skills, like we've talked about the skills gap, get more education, so they really can put themselves in a position, ultimately, to be able to transition off of public assistance. Historically, we just haven't focused on that investment in people. And so, you know, we have folks who've been on cash assistance or on TANF for a while, and all we're doing is just trying to push them out the door into jobs. And so to the extent we're successful, we might get them into a job, but it's a low-paying job typically. And then when something happens, inevitably, whether you know they lose their transportation or lose their child care access or whatever it is and lose that job, they come right back into our system. And so we just churn people in and out of our programs without really thinking, are we putting them on a long-term path to success? And that's really what we're focused on now.
Sharon, there are several thoughts going through my mind as we're talking about this. That financial literacy part of it would seem to be very important, and it ties into what Secretary Miller was just talking about, too. I mean, there are a lot of people who, even if they are making good money, don't really understand how to manage their money, manage their family finances. So I would think that that financial literacy part would be very important.
It's tremendously important, and it's important to in our world to focus on financial management for low wage, economically fragile workers, because a lot of financial management teaching starts in the tens of thousands. Like, you know, they assume that you have a higher income than maybe the people that we're working with, but also there's a mentality. I mean, our team came to the financial literacy part and we started talking about a budget, and they're like, I don't need a budget. That budget's for somebody with money. I don't have any money. And so you start back from that, and we talk about envelope systems and how to predict your expenses. It's really a very basic starting point. And then very quickly, people catch on.
How many employees do you have?
Right now, we have 60.
60. Do you know them all?
Yes. And
do you know their backgrounds?
Pretty much about them, yes.
You do?
Yes.
So creating a culture.
Not just me. I mean, we have a very, very high touch culture.
Creating a culture is very important to you under this model. What kind of culture are you trying to create?
A culture where every person is of equal value and everyone can be heard and wants to be heard. That they want to be seen and valued and validated, and that's what we're doing. And it takes some time, but consistency and being trustworthy, people will open up, and it's a fabulous, fabulous journey. The stories I could tell about people who have succeeded and have accomplished things beyond their dreams, it's a great ride. I think it's so much fun. I'm like, everybody should do this.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll talk about that with Dave Black in just a moment about why everyone should do it. But I mean, obviously, there's a social aspect to this, that there's some compassion behind it. But there are business reasons for doing this, as you write in the book. True?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, when you started off by talking about an economic downturn, I'm like, good for me, because I have a competitive advantage. And that is, I have something substantive to say to my clients and prospective clients about what Dasher is actually accomplishing by working with them. And so it does create, it just makes us different and better.
What is that culture?
Oh, it's just a culture of self-fulfillment. I mean, it's a work culture is the air you breathe. It's your way of talking to each other at the workplace. It's your constant behaviors, and we have a repetitive process to reinforce the behaviors that we really need to have in our culture. Our hiring is based on our culture. Our development is based on our culture. Everything revolves around our culture.
But again, one of the key business parts of this is turnover.
Yes.
That you mentioned earlier that you have a 90% retention rate.
Well, higher than that. It's actually our turnover is in the single digits.
Okay. And actually, there are some statistics that show that even though we have full employment under the definition of full employment, that there still is a high turnover rate amongst employers in this country.
Incredibly high.
Which probably cost employers a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. It's a considerable amount of money. And a lot of people ask me, how do you pay for this? I'm like, I'll say it in maybe a better way. I'm kicking your butt. I'm saving money by doing this, a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. So when you say a better way, kicking your butt, my imagination is running with it. So Dave Black, this culture, and you mentioned it earlier, but that a culture that you think a lot of employers should create. Why?
Well, this is a model that helps to address the workforce issue that every single employer out there has. You talk for a minute to anybody who has a company, a business, in government, biggest challenge is workforce, workforce, workforce. So what Dasher has done is to create this supportive culture. So it's in some cases taking people that other people might not hire and developing them into truly quality employees that not only benefit what Dasher's doing, but if they leave Dasher, they're going to be contributing to the larger workforce. And you know, as we watch workforce demographics, you know, we've read a lot of things that the workforce crisis is probably not going to peak until 2025.
All right, what do you mean by that?
Well, and it's basically caused by baby boomers who are retiring at the rate of 10,000 a day, and there's just not as many people coming in. That's kind of the fundamental level of it. But there's it's much more complex than that. And then you have the millennials and the Gen Zs who are coming into the workforce, and it's a work-life balance is very, very important to them. So you look at the culture that Dasher has. This is creating a nice place to work. Not only am I getting a steady paycheck, am I advancing in my career, but I'm learning stuff that's really helping me and my family out in life. I've got a support system. If my car breaks down, if my HVAC system, you know, blows up, I have somebody to cover it. So it's creating the kind of system that I think people in the workplace are looking for. And what it tells all of us who are employers is that, okay, we've got to rethink what we've been doing in workforce. It's not just as easy as putting a sign up and saying help wanted. You've got to do more today. And it's in many ways it's bringing the workforce and the employers better together and creating, I'll call it, a synergistic model that you have here. It's benefiting the corporate bottom line of Dasher, but it's also very much helping these people who are being hired by Dasher and who are growing their skill sets. They're smarter with their own personal finances once they get started in the process, and they're making a more than a family sustaining wage because they keep advancing within the company.
All right, you used two words there that there may be many people thinking about. Bottom line, let's face it: for-profit businesses are in business for profit to make money. Yes, Sharon, this may be considered an investment in people, but at the same time, there may be employers out there, businesses out there that are saying, you know, I don't work for the Department of Human Services. I'm not here so much to improve. Yeah, we take care of our employees, but my priority is my customers. What about that? I mean, you said that you're doing pretty well, but for those who may look at it and say, I would rather make sure that my customers are satisfied than my employees. Now, they may not say it that way, but you know what I mean.
Our number one priority at Dasher every day is to deliver a customer experience that makes working with Dasher productive and valuable and enjoyable. So that's our number one priority every single day. And what we're doing positions us well to be able to do that because we don't have turnover. We have great people, talented people, dedicated people, engaged people who are serving our customers. And most of our clients are long-term customers. They're global companies. They have high expectations, and we blow them away.
Dave, that culture we're talking about and workforce, in your position, when we are trying to attract entrepreneurs, attract businesses, employers to Central Pennsylvania, I'm sure that's one of the first questions anyone would have is wanting to know what the workforce is like, what the work ethic is like. How does that translate into an answer from what we've been discussing this morning?
This, what Sharon has created, is something that enhances our work ethic by creating more people with work skills, with life skills that fit this. And I want to make it clear, we're not spending a lot of time anymore attracting businesses here. We're trying to help entrepreneurs, but we're trying to help our local companies grow, trying to help them with workforce issues, trying to attract workforce really more than we're trying to attract business. Now, business attracts itself. We know we've got a great transportation system, so we've got all these distribution centers around here. They're coming. We're growing in that regard. But even if you look at some of the very large employers, you look at the Amazon of the world, they're starting to make a shift. It's tough to do it in a huge company versus a company the size of Dasher, but they are starting to develop career paths, trying to help their employees. So this is not unique to a company like Dasher, and businesses are starting to get it.
I just want to make a point.
Sure.
I mean, I'm a little business, and I wrote a book on how to do this. I mean, a big business should be able to have 20 people who could sit down and figure this out. I mean, I don't think it's for a small business. It's for every business.
Mm. Secretary Miller, you said earlier that even though there are job training programs and programs that the state has out there that we haven't done, we meaning the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, I assume, haven't done a good job with trying to work with the whole person, if I could put words in your mouth. So yeah. What do we have to do across the state, across this country, that we are able to make someone who is, a person is not just a number, but someone who is a valued worker with their employer?
I think, and you took the perfect words out of my mouth in terms of the whole person focus, and I think that's what's so beautiful about Sharon's model is they look at people as a whole person who has a lot of different needs, who are complex, and rather than just that third shift when you don't make it, just saying goodbye and then going out and recruiting, they invest in people and make sure that we're addressing all of those needs. And that's exactly, I see a lot of opportunity, especially with the economy doing as well as it's doing right now, for us, for example, at the department and the administration to partner with businesses, because we're all trying to figure out how do we help get people that we serve into good paying jobs. Businesses are really needing skilled workers. And so we're starting to see businesses, for example, get creative about things like trying to address childcare needs and maybe either partnering with a local childcare facility or maybe creating on-site childcare. So it takes one of those big barriers that people face just off the table. And they're doing things like offering shuttles or Uber services to get people to work to address another big barrier of transportation. So I think it's really about all of us. And again, we're looking at all of our programs trying to do this better, but how are we all taking a look at the whole person and making sure that we're looking at them as more than just a worker and addressing some of the barriers that we know exist for them to be quality workers who are there every day and doing great work?
Sharon, we have a question from Kathleen, wants to know how Dasher is doing financially.
Dasher is doing wonderfully. We're economically strong, we're financially disciplined, and we're ready to grow, keep growing.
How did this develop? We kind of talked about writing the book and the model and all that, but where along the line did you realize that, if we aim at this group of financially fragile people or economically fragile people and bring them in, teach them some life skills, teach them, some job training skills. When did that finally click or kick in?
Well, what happened was we began noticing that our cherished coworkers had stresses outside of work that we couldn't even begin to understand. And so we also understood, though, that they didn't want us to run right up to them and ask them about them. So we had to learn about that, and we describe how we did that in a book. But what we did was we developed some minimum viable solutions in business speak. That's one way to attack one issue. And so we would develop that and test it and debug it and test it and debug it. And then we kept going, and we actually incorporated all those minimum viable solutions into a process and organize it into a 7-step model. So it was applying business principles to a social issue.
The name of the book is The Talent Pool, How to Find and Keep Dedicated People While Making a Lasting Impact. Sharon Ryan is the CEO at Dasher Service Incorporated. She's co-author of the book. David Black, President and CEO of Harrisburg Regional Chamber and Cretic, and Pennsylvania Secretary of Human Services, Teresa Miller. Thank all of you for being with us today.
Thanks.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Coming up on tomorrow's program, an update on invasive species in Pennsylvania waterways and on the spotted lanternfly, still a problem here in Pennsylvania. Well, we were just talking about a culture of people who are economically, who are fragile economically, having a hard time paying for the essentials in life. Here's something that is related somewhat. The American dream is the ideal that opportunity is available to every American, and prosperity and success are achieved through hard work. Sociologist and author Jennifer Silva believes the dream's promise is withering away for many people, that addiction, joblessness, and family dysfunction are the reasons. Jennifer Silva joins us here in Smart Talk to discuss her book, We're Still Here, Pain and Politics in the Heart of America. Jennifer Silva, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
If you would like to weigh in, give us a call at 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So what prompted the book? Why did you want to write this book?
That's a great question. I was interested in politics because I wrote my first book about young adults, working everyday young adults. And I talked to them about what it meant to grow up today. And many of them told stories about feeling very disillusioned and distrustful. They didn't believe that they would be able to achieve what their parents had achieved because the cost of education was so high, jobs had become very insecure, and also because they felt like they'd lost a sense of community attachment. And so in 2015, knowing an election was coming up, I thought it would be really interesting to go back out there and talk to working class, everyday Americans about their political views and how they connected their everyday life experiences and struggles and hopes and fears to politics.
Well, there is some politics in the book because it is leading up to the 2016 presidential election, but not a lot of politics. Mostly you're describing the lives of the people that you talk to. Now, this is situated, you situated yourself, embedded yourself, if you will, in a coal mining area of northeastern Pennsylvania that you call Colebrook. Why did you choose that area of the country? And then I'll follow up by asking, why not name the town?
Oh, that's really interesting. So I was an assistant professor at Bucknell University, and I was interested in revitalization efforts that were going on in the anthracite coal region. And I was also very fascinated by the history of the coal region. As someone interested in social class and inequality, I thought the history of coal with the miners going on strikes and the unions was just really fascinating. And I thought it would be really interesting to go and see what had happened now that many of the coal jobs have gone away and some of the problems that came along with that are, you know, alcoholism and addiction and families breaking apart and communities being weaker because people are leaving, but also at the same time, you know, local residents trying to make it better. So it seemed like this really interesting site to go talk to people about the American dream and how they were making sense of what had happened to them.
But suffice to say, Colebrook, the area you name, is fairly close to us here in the Harrisburg, Lancaster, York area. That Schuylkill, Carbon counties, those areas, that's Colebrook?
All around those areas is where I would find Colebrook. You know, part of what I do is, you know, I go into people's lives. They let me into their homes. They share secrets with me. They share really intimate details of their lives. And because of that, I felt like I needed to protect them. And so I use a pseudonym for the town that gives people a level of plausible deniability so they can say, no, that isn't me, if later they, you know, they feel vulnerable. Because, you know, for me as a researcher, my number one priority is to keep the people I talk to safe.
Well, I have to say that you did talk with a lot of people. How many people did you talk to in all?
Over 100 people. So I think the book is based on 108 working people, and then I also talked to a lot of townspeople and spent a lot of time kind of hanging out at football games and restaurants and festivals in the coal region.
Yeah, so something that many of us would recognize with that are social events or places where people gather in the coal regions of Pennsylvania. You know, one of the things I have to say that is a little bit surprising when you say that people talked about some of their most intimate details of their lives is how much they opened up to you. How did you get them to do that?
It was really amazing. I basically just took a lot of time. I started off as an outsider, and, you know, these are small towns where everyone knows everyone else, and so I stood out right away. I was very lucky that a few people believed in my research and took me under their wing and started introducing me to their friends and family. And I found that as soon as people started to trust me, they would actually invite me into their homes, or I would, you know, hang out with them while they were going about their daily lives, and they started sharing many of their personal stories. And, you know, people would tell me stories about addiction affecting their family, or about struggling to make ends meet, or even about domestic violence. But they told it to me in a way where they weren't ashamed of it. They were proud to be grappling with it, or proud to be trying to overcome it.
Well, up until this point, I've talked mostly about process. I just want to kind of establish that for the audience out there. But you just brought up a few of the problems that most of the people you talked with are dealing with: low wages, alcoholism, drug addiction, domestic violence, unhealthy relationships, and racism. Quite frankly, you know, when I read the book, I'm thinking, boy, this is kind of depressing.
I'm sorry. I know it can be a little bit of a depressing read, but it's also capturing reality for people who are struggling, who are struggling to find jobs that pay a family wage. As my respondents would tell me, you know, you can't, it's really hard to support a family when you're making $9 an hour. And they actually, many of the people felt very angry. They felt like politicians were not protecting them from exploitation and poverty, and they felt like it was becoming harder and harder to give their children a good life. One thing I heard over and over was that there weren't many opportunities for kids left in these towns because not much was being invested in the schools. There weren't safe places or activities for kids to engage in, and they were really worried.
You know, and you don't have to apologize for it. I'm just saying that a lot of the stories that you tell, you know, I got to thinking to myself that probably there may not be a lot of Americans who realize that there are many, many people in working class neighborhoods or areas where industry has left and they don't have the kind of jobs that they once did, that are living this way with, I mean, battling a lot of the same issues, correct?
That's right. They're battling many issues when they feel like they're on their own. So they may be dealing with addiction, or they might be dealing with poverty, where families getting disrupted, and they feel like they're on their own to deal with that. They don't have a lot of safety nets. They feel like their community ties are pretty fragile. You know, they don't really have like a church or a club or something to reach out to for help. And they also don't see many opportunities for mobility. And I think the main theme of my book is not really, you know, I wanted to talk to people about politics, but what they wanted to talk about was the pain of everyday life. Not only, you know, the struggle to pay the bills, but all the ways that economic hardship seeps into their lives through stress and harming their family relationships and addiction.
You know, you say that many of them didn't want to talk about politics. I think we journalists often will try to talk to people about politics, and it's just not that important to many people. Or I think what comes through in your book is that most of the people that you talk to did not have a lot of faith that government was working for them. In fact, I know a couple of people that you mentioned there who felt that the system was rigged. And taking it one step further, most blame themselves for their own problems. But at the same time, many of them pointed fingers at others for taking advantage of the system, meaning welfare or immigration, correct?
That's right. So I went into the research thinking that people would have strong political views, but I was surprised to find that probably two-thirds of the people I spoke with had pretty much given up on both political parties, and they didn't believe that either side had their best interests in mind. So some of the most powerful quotes, one young man told me, you know, when it comes to voting, I don't believe a president will change anything. I feel like politicians and the government are the biggest liars in the world. And so basically what they felt was that if they depended on politicians or really on any social institutions, such as education or military, then if they depended on outsiders, then they would be disappointed and it would actually hurt them more because they felt so betrayed by these larger social institutions.
No, I was going to say, when you did talk politics with them, this was leading up to the 2016 presidential election, you ask whether they were going to vote, whether they did vote, who they voted for. But before we get to who they voted for, the majority of the people that you spoke with didn't vote at all, correct?
That's right.
Which that kind of, I don't know if apathy is the right word, or that lack of confidence in the institutions or government out there, that leads to people not voting.
That's true. And I don't know if I'd call it apathy, because they were pretty informed and they could talk a lot about politics. They just believed that the system had been rigged. And by that, I mean they believed that politicians were serving the interests of wealthy people and corporations over the interests of workers. And in a way, they felt like if they voted, they were just justifying the system, when no matter who they voted for, they believed that no one cared about them. So they believed no politician would help them get their health back or help them get jobs back or invest in education. And they actually wanted, you know, higher taxes, for example, and more investment in schools for kids, but they felt like no one was going to look out for them and do that.
So you did ask, you know, if they voted, but you also asked who they voted for. And as we just said, the majority of the people you spoke with didn't vote. But those who did, who did they vote for president?
So the two favorites from the very beginning of my research, which was in 2015, were Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. And this was because they believed that these candidates were honest. And, for example, they would say, oh, I like Bernie's heart. I think he cares about working people. I like Donald Trump's honesty. He doesn't care about impressing people or saying the right things. And so what was really coming through was that their distrust of the system made anyone who seemed like, who wasn't a politician, seemed like a better choice or a safer choice.
Racism was also something that you wrote about in the book. You not just spoke with white working class people in northeastern Pennsylvania, but you also spoke with African Americans and Latinos. What did you find when it comes to racism?
I found that the coal region is experiencing a lot of flux and a lot of change when it comes to race. And so what we see is an area that has been predominantly white for a long time is experiencing a growing number of racial and ethnic minorities moving in because the housing is more affordable and there may be more jobs, and it seems safer than some of the cities that they're coming from in, you know, New York or D.C. And I did find that this was causing a lot of tension around who belongs and around identity. And so among some of the white men I spoke to, not all of them, there was a sense that they were very proud of their identity as a white person, and they felt like they needed to protect their town from outsiders moving in. And, you know, I did hear there was sort of a sense of resentment. So, you know, there was one white man who was unemployed, and he had he was struggling with health. He used to be a Democrat, but now he was disillusioned and felt like no politicians could help him get his health back. And he would tell me, you know, a race war is coming, and, you know, tell me that America was becoming a wasteland and, you know, all of our resources were being taken over by non-white people. And so I did hear this very scary vision of America, that, you know, America is this broken wasteland and we're going to have a race war. I do think the racial identity for these men became stronger when their other identities, like being a provider or being a husband or father, were not available.
We only have about 20 seconds left. And one thing, if you could quickly answer this question, when you talk about power and men, it seems as though almost everyone you talk to, that the men had the power, correct?
I think it's changing. I think women are changing their roles, where they're less about having, you know, roles as wives and mothers and kind of trying to figure out who they can be when those aren't available anymore.
Jennifer Suva is the author of We're Still Here, Pain in Politics in the Heart of America. Ms. Suva, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we talk about invasive species in Pennsylvania waterways and the spotted lanternfly.